you're talking to a significant partner and you're saying, hey, listen, I love you. I want to take the next step. I think we should move in together. Having said that,
just in case,
here's a document that I had my lawyer prepare.
Let's just slide it across the table here.
Welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee. And on the show today, I'll be talking to Sandra Foster, the author of Canada's best-selling estate planning book. And she'll be breaking down what you need to know about estate planning, no matter your age, no matter how much or how little money you have, and your state of health. But before I introduce Sandra, a shout out to the listeners who've left star ratings on iTunes. We've passed 250 ratings, which is another nice little milestone. And a special thanks this week to Norma3356, who liked the series of interviews with the CEOs from a few robo-advisory services who have been guests recently. Catherine Brick, who said she's trying to get other people to listen as well. Thank you for your efforts. And Andrew416 and Aureliano Pisa, who also left very nice notes. If you haven't done so, I really do appreciate you taking 5 seconds to leave a rating on iTunes. And if you want to take the additional time to write in a comment on top of that, I do read them all. And now on to today's guest. Sandra Foster is one of Canada's leading experts on personal finance and a national best-selling author. She is the founder of Headspring Consulting Incorporated and a speaker, consultant, researcher, developer of accredited continuing education programs for advisors, and much, much more. She does not sell any investments or insurance, and she does bring real-world experience to estate planning, having been told to ensure her affairs were in order and that her family knew her wishes regarding organ donation. Modern science, determination, and luck only reinforced her passion for estate planning. Sandra, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here in more ways than one.
Good, yeah. So, you know what? That's a hell of a bio. So without revealing anything you don't want to, what can you tell us about that ordeal where you were told you have to get your affairs in order and tell your family about your wishes about organ donation?
Well, not everybody knew everything, and that's one thing that I think is important for people to know. You don't have to tell people more than you want to know, but it's important to tell them what they need to know. So I do walk the talk when it comes to estate planning, but I was at the point where my children had all turned 18, or the youngest, the twins had turned 18. Okay. So I was at the point where it was a good time for me to refresh my estate plan. So my lawyer was able to update my paperwork in 3 days, which is when my surgery was happening, so that my documents were in order. But let me tell you, when something happens to you like that, the last thing you want to be doing is paperwork.
Even on a good day, the last thing I want to do is paperwork.
Certainly, certainly. But so I recommend to people that if they have a will, if they're one of the 58 or 52 or 42%, depending on which study you're reading, right, that has a will, that you take it out and dust it off and read it every once in a while to make sure that it says what you want it to say.
Okay, so before we get more into that, normal format for my show is I like to learn a little bit about the career path for the guests for a couple of reasons. Especially in today's day and age, doesn't seem like there's really a linear trajectory for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people take some solace and some, they just feel better about not maybe having a direction when for the younger listeners in life about where they're going to end up. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your path, starting from, you know, what you studied in school and how you ended up doing what you do today.
My career path is very eclectic.
Okay, I love it already.
I probably have had 6 or 7 different careers in my lifetime to date, and I'm not sure that I'm finished right with my ultimate career. There still may be another one in the works. I started university studying urban studies and psychology after a year in math. and I could not figure out for the life of
me. Sorry, did you say after a year of math or meth?
Math.
Okay.
No, I actually remember my first year because I could not for the life of me figure out what I would do specializing in math at that point.
Right.
Little did I know, but I graduated having studied urban studies mm-hmm. and psychology. And I ended up working for a trust company writing procedures.
Okay.
Little did I know that I would end up writing books at that point.
So when you say writing procedures, like a technical writer?
Like a technical writer.
Okay.
Only did that for a little while. And then I ended up in what we would call IT today.
Okay.
So I ended up programming and becoming a project manager. Being in front of screens all day, that was not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know that I would end up writing in front of screens.
Right.
I had a human resource designation, so I worked with people and were talking to them about being hired and fired and their careers.
Mm-hmm.
And was sitting in an office talking to someone just in a waiting room, and someone I met somewhere before, and they said, well, you should take the Canadian Securities Institute exam.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why.
Okay.
But I did.
All right.
And ended up becoming what would have been called at that point a stockbroker.
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly for me, thought that I needed to be a planner as well.
Okay.
So became a planner, wrote a couple of books, and had to make a decision as to whether I was going to service clients or go on the road speaking and talking to people. And I chose to become the speaker consultant route.
Okay. And so how long were you a stockbroker? Like what time period would that have been?
Through the 80s and early 90s.
Okay. So you lived through the stock market crash of 87
and
you were
on the desk. Through the stock market crash, yes.
Yeah. So what was that like?
Well, some people survived and some people didn't, quite literally.
Right.
So
yeah.
I saw some really difficult life stories for people.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say, don't put all your money in the market, don't leverage too much, I can tell you stories where it really did not work out well for people.
I'll bet. So, okay, so you decided that you wanted to go on the road and be a speaker and a consultant and talk about planning. So how did you go from that to estate planning in particular?
Well, it was family. When they say you did it for family,
right?
I have four children. And at the time, I had four very young children. And I did not know who would look after my children if something was to happen to my husband and I.
Right.
So I was not focused on estate planning because I was worried about estate planning for my children at that point. I was worried about it because I was worried about my children. Who
right.
would look after our children if something was to happen to us?
Mm-hmm.
Because our family was young, and having four children and asking someone, hey, would you look after my four children if something was to happen to us, was a really, really big question.
Right. Right. And so let's start with this. So let's start with the basics. So, you know, listeners on this podcast span the range from young to old. Regulators listen, financial advisors listen, people who are learning about personal finance for the first time are listening. But let's start from the very basics. Let's say you are younger and maybe you've just started a family. What happens if you die without a will?
Well, if you die without a will, you die with what's called intestate. And having a will gives you two things. One, it lets you decide who's going to settle your estate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you die without a will, you don't have someone who's going to settle your estate. So the government will decide who's going to settle it. And secondly, the government decides who gets what. And
is the government a good executor?
Well, they have a schedule of rules and regulations that they follow. The problem is that you don't have any choice in who gets what.
Right.
So if you have children, as an example, children that are under the age of 18, that money is held in trust in mm-hmm. most provinces. And when that child turns 18 or 19, depending on where you live, they would get the money outright. Now, I don't remember what, no, if you remember what you were like when you were 18 or 19.
I was a complete idiot.
So, you know, I don't know what you would have done with the money at that point, but a lot of people I've talked to would not like their children receiving the money outright at 18 or 19, especially if they've worked hard for it. And it doesn't have to be a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's just money they've worked hard for. And they want to make sure that money doesn't spoil their children, right, or isn't, or the children aren't good stewards of it or don't know how to be good stewards of it yet.
Right. Okay. So if you die without a will, the government basically has a prescribed schedule that says, well, here's how the assets are going to be distributed and they're going to take care of everything, but it may not be according to your wishes.
It may not be,
so
yes.
At the very least, you should get a will so that you can sort of outline exactly what you want, because the government doesn't know the nuances of your family dynamics. And
well, not everybody's married, mm-hmm, and families come in all shapes and sizes, and the government's schedule doesn't accommodate that.
Right. Okay. So let's say now that you've decided, okay, I should probably go and get a will. What else do you need to consider when it comes to estate plan? Because it's not just the will. You could become, you know, incapacitated and not die. So don't read your will if you haven't died, but you can become incapacitated. So what are you supposed to do in those situations?
Sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it?
Not really.
Well, it's not something you have to think about a lot of times, but right. The other part of estate planning is another document, and in most provinces, it's referred to as a proxy or a power of attorney, and mm-hmm, there's actually two. There's one that looks after your finances, and there's one for your instructions regarding your health care.
Right.
So the one for your finances, in a lot of ways, is like your will, except there's no final distribution on your death. You appoint someone who will decide what happens to your finances, who's going to pay your bills, who's going to manage those finances while you're alive in your best interest.
Right.
And the other document is who's going to make personal decisions about your health care.
Right.
On your behalf.
So same question. Let's say, you know, instead of dying without a will, let's say you die without these powers of attorney or healthcare directives, because I know the different provinces have slightly different names, but they all basically address the same thing. So sometimes living will, etc. So let's say that you don't have those set up. So what would happen, and you don't have to give a specific example, but in general, what would happen if you became incapacitated and your bills pile up at home and you're not there to make the transactions on your computer to process the bill payments and whatnot? What are the dangers of becoming incapacitated and not having these powers of attorney set up?
Well, in a worst case scenario, you have bills pile up,
yeah,
and eventually the public trustee would get involved and have to pay those bills, or a family member might step forward and be appointed as a person to settle your bills, and they would have to figure out what bills are to be paid and get the power to pay those bills and create spreadsheets and report to the public trustee of that province to make sure they're doing everything, crossing the I's and dotting the T's, so to speak.
And so the public trustee, just so the listeners are clear, let's say that you have no family and you become incapacitated. Someone will probably tell the government, hey, listen, this person's in the hospital, they're incapacitated, and then they would step in and appoint a public trustee who would act on their behalf.
Well, the public trustee would be appointed.
Yeah.
And then the public trustee has employees,
okay,
who would become your trustee,
right,
for your finances while you're alive. And then they would make the best decisions they can in your best interest. So if you're able to stay in your house, they would make the decisions to pay the bills and keep you in your home. If you're not able to stay in your house, they would decide where you would live.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's say that, you know, you've decided to be an adult and you say, yes, I'm going to get a will and maybe learn more about these powers of attorney. Where do you go? So do you just Google, where do I get a will in Toronto or Vancouver or Chilliwack, and then look at the first search engine listing that pops up and say, you know, I should go there? Or how do you vet a lawyer and know that you're dealing with someone who is the right person to be dealing with for your situation?
Well, when lawyers go to law school, they all learn how to prepare wills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they can all prepare a will. And one of the rules of thumb is you want to keep your will and your estate planning as simple as possible. But being simple isn't necessarily the best thing because you may not know what you don't know when it comes to estate planning.
Right.
So lawyers, like other professionals, specialize. So some lawyers specialize in real estate. Some lawyers specialize in estate planning. And some lawyers specialize in criminal law. So if you have a complex situation, you really want a lawyer who specializes in estate planning. So you can look online. The Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners has lawyers who have the TEP designation after their name. That's one place to start. There's also lists that online that you can vet. And you can also speak to people who have had success with their lawyer and have a will that is very comfortable, or a financial planner can refer you to a lawyer.
Right. So if for most people who have a, say they're early in their lives and they haven't had the opportunity to maybe have a divorce and remarriage and kids from other, it's going to be a relatively simple situation. So picking a lawyer is not as daunting a task as opposed to having a more complex situation where you're a co-owner in a business and there are significant assets and distributed across your family. And
at that stage of life with relatively simple financial situation, I think the more daunting situation is actually getting to it,
right,
as opposed to picking to the lawyer.
Yeah,
a lot
you're
of people,
right.
Some people are very superstitious when it comes to having a will. I was at a book signing on the weekend and people were saying, yeah, I know I should do one, but I'm not sure what it is that keeps me from getting my will done.
Yeah. You know, I totally agree with that. Everyone I talk to, and I'll give you an example. I knew a guy, worked on Bay Street, well-known guy, very wealthy, very smart, works in the field of finance, deals a lot with financial advisors, and had two or three young kids. And I think his eldest kid was 7. And he said, yeah, I still don't have my wills and powers of attorney set up. And I thought, this is unbelievable. I mean, you are one of the smartest financial minds. You work in the financial advisory business. And even that person was, succumbing to this either procrastination, fear of mortality, fear of facing, what happens at the end. I don't know. But it is a very daunting thing for people. So what can we do to motivate people to do what we know we should do, but we don't do?
It's a difficult issue to motivate people. And it's not just wills when it comes to dealing with financial issues. So I think that if people understand, it's really not as difficult to prepare a will and to get a will done, and that it's not a matter of if you need one.
Right. Hey, listen, I plan on living forever, so
well,
I probably won't need a will.
That just does not happen as much as we want to. And we all know people in our lives who have died what we would consider too young.
Right.
Or who have left a mess. Or
right.
Who we can say, oh, I wish they had, or they should have, or they could have. Well, mm-hmm. Everybody has the opportunity to sign the piece of papers and take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as important as taking care of your finances, taking care of your family. And really, that's what this is about. This is taking care of your family,
right,
and the people you care about.
So I think for a lot of people, the trigger point is when they have kids. They start to think about, what will happen if. But what about, let's say, a couple who hasn't had children yet, hasn't gotten married yet, but a lot of people are delaying marriage and having kids, but they're living together. So are there any consequences or considerations that common law couples need to consider when it comes to estate planning?
I'm glad you asked that question. When people do their taxes, if they live common law, there's a box that they're probably checking off. Have you lived together for a year? You're living common law. There's certain things that then follow through on your taxes. In Ontario and a couple of other provinces, if you live common law, you're not automatically entitled to your partner's property on death.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a marriage contract, if you have a will, if you've named your partner as beneficiaries, then some of those may take the place of parts of a will.
Right.
But in all provinces in Canada, the first 2 or 3 years you live together, there are no property rights guaranteed. And then in a province of Ontario, which covers much of the population of Canada, people make the assumption that common law is the same as married.
Right.
And that's a big mistake.
Right. And it is important to note, because this is a topic that comes up time and time again, the definition of common law in the eyes of the CRA is different from a legal perspective when it comes to property division, as you just laid out.
It's completely different.
Right.
The timing is different.
Okay. So your common law, you wouldn't have a marriage contract, but you would have what they call, I guess it would be a domestic agreement.
Well, it's called a domestic agreement. Some people call it a living together agreement.
Right.
It doesn't really matter what you call the contract as long as it's prepared properly and it serves the function.
And that needs to be prepared by a lawyer, correct?
It should be prepared by a lawyer, and it should have the proper disclosures, and each party should get independent legal advice at the time it's prepared.
And I imagine, you know, when people procrastinate when it comes to a will and powers of attorney, if you're common law, I imagine that's even a steeper hill to climb when it comes to, hey, we should prepare a contract just in case this doesn't work out, right? I mean, that's a tough conversation to have, isn't it?
My experience is it's actually easier to prepare wills than it is to prepare a contract saying, just in case it doesn't work out, let's sign this paper.
Right. Yeah, I can't, you know, you're talking to a significant partner and you're saying, hey, listen, I love you. I want to take the next step. I think we should move in together. Having said that,
just in case,
here's a document that I had my lawyer prepare.
That's just slide it across the table here.
Yeah, so very difficult. So again, all you can do, I guess, at this point is say, listen, you really should consider it. But I think the reality is a lot of people, it's that advice probably falls on deaf ears.
Well, even if you've been living together, you're younger and you've been living together for 2 or 3 years, or what we have today is we have gray divorces, and then we have couples living together in a different generation
right.
as well. And their situations are more complex, but the human issues are no simpler.
Right.
It's still difficult to have those conversations.
Right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about, you know, maybe some older listeners. I know in the press release with the book, there is some questions about alter ego trusts. So I want to ask you, first of all, what is an alter ego trust? Is that like when Garth Brooks released that album as Chris Gaines using an alter ego? Does that have to do with, you know, if you've got multiple personalities? What is an alter ego
trust? It's not a Jekyll and Hyde type of thing at all. no, it's actually a tax structure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're 65 or older, you can take some of the assets that you have in your own name and move them into what's called an alter ego trust. And that allows you to name them and give them the name of the trust. And that allows you for estate planning purposes to avoid probate on your death. Because the alter ego trust has wording on it on your death that's somewhat like a will.
Okay.
But doesn't have to be probated.
So when you transfer the assets into an alter ego trust, is there a deemed disposition? Like you have to pay taxes once you set up that trust?
No, that's one of the benefits of an alter ego trust, is there doesn't have to be a deemed disposition.
Okay, and what about the, you know, every 21 years, most trusts will have a deemed disposition. Is that circumvented with an alter ego trust?
As long as you're alive, you don't have to worry about the 21-year rule. And if you set up a joint partner trust, that's in the name of you and your spouse. It's much like an alter ego trust, except it's for two people.
Oh, so kind of like a joint last to die sort of structure?
It's kind of like a joint last to die structure. So as long as you're alive, that deemed disposition and the 21-year rules don't apply.
So, okay, so if the main advantage is to bypass probate?
That's one of the advantages. Mm-hmm. The other advantage that people look at is that you get to name a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
And because you name a trustee and can set up formal rules for how your money will be managed and how your assets will be taken care of, some people see it also as a more formal arrangement than a power of attorney for finances.
Well, this is interesting. So one of the issues that is becoming more and more apparent is cognitive decline when you've got assets that you manage. And it's very difficult for the people that, you know, your financial advisor. They don't have the power, they don't have the training to diagnose when you are mentally incapacitated due to cognitive decline. So how are they supposed to know and detect that when they see you maybe a couple times a year, if that? So this sounds like a pretty good mechanism where you could deal with that if you had the foresight to set this up and say, hey, listen, I realize that as I get older, the likelihood of me suffering some kind of cognitive decline goes up as I get older. And so having this in place might be a good way to designate someone that you trust, which I guess is figuring out who that person is going to be is a big decision, but that they could manage those in your best interests.
There is that advantage to it. Now, there's a few other tax wrinkles mm-hmm. that are involved, and you never want the tax rules to guide your planning.
Right.
So you need to investigate all the rules for a particular person's situation. But there are areas where the alter ego trust has benefits for people for sure.
And so this sounds like with most trusts, because there are costs associated with setting up trusts, this is probably looks more like something that you want to plan for depending on how much money you have. So if it's, you know, if you're looking at $50,000 that you've got there, that may not be a good candidate from a cost perspective. But if you've got $1 million, then maybe more favorable from a cost perspective.
From a cost perspective, because not only are there the setup costs, there's the ongoing costs every year, there's the costs for the trustee, there's the tax filings every year. So yes, you're absolutely right.
Okay. Okay, so let's change gears a little bit and talk about digital assets.
Ah.
Because this is a topic, again, that is becoming more and more apparent that needs more attention when it comes to planning. And I remember I had a lawyer on 2 years ago or something, and we talked about music collections. So classic example, you know, my grandparents' generation, they would have spent maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars collecting vinyl and then replicating that collection with CDs. And they could leave that to whoever they wanted in their will, and the person who received it could enjoy it, no questions asked. Switch over to the iTunes generation. And when you buy a song for 99 cents or an album for 10 bucks, you're actually just buying the license for your personal use of that music. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have the terminology perfect, but essentially when you die, you can't actually transfer that music library over to your kid or whoever you name in your will. Although some people will say, well, here's my password to my iTunes account, which I believe is technically violating the 90-page terms of service agreement that you...
Sometimes it's only 48 or 50 pages.
Yeah, I mean, no one reads those terms of service agreements. They just blindly click on them, right, when
exactly.
they get the update. And I think that technically sharing your iTunes password is a violation of that. So really, you can't pass on your music collection. So when it comes to digital assets, that is one example of many that we need to consider. So what does this generation do when it comes to considering digital assets?
It's a whole new chapter in the book.
Oh,
in
there
the
we go.
Sixth edition. So there are a few things. Let's start with the licensing mm-hmm. of content. So your music collection. In some cases, you can share content. So
okay.
you can actually buy, in some situations, a family license.
Uh-huh.
So you may not be violating the agreement if you have what's called a family license or something that looks like a family license.
Mm-hmm.
But you're perfectly right in saying that if you have a single license, you're violating if you share it. And on death, that license is non-transferable.
Right.
So you haven't bought the music. That's why it's only 99 cents.
Right. So one of the options would then be to look at a family license. Otherwise, I guess, you know, technology moves so fast. I mean, now you've got a lot of people who just pay, I think Apple came up with this, you know, just a monthly subscription fee, and you've got access to whatever songs you want to listen to or stuff like that. So you're not you're no longer acquiring individual songs, you're acquiring access to a huge library at a monthly cost.
And I think that's one of the reasons they did it, because right. people were violating licenses and monthly subscriptions, monthly fees. That's a very good revenue model for the people on the other end.
And have you looked at, you know, what happens to your Instagram account, your Facebook account? Because there's some people... there's this this new business model of having influencers on various social media, and they promote brands, they generate revenue from their Instagram account, which is tied to how many followers and likes that they get. So there's value to these accounts. And what happens to those accounts when people die? Because I've had friends who have passed away, and every now and then I see, you know, their name mentioned on my Facebook feed for whatever reason. It's so-and-so's birthday and whatnot. I mean, this is, there's a real like creepy factor to it as well, right?
Well, personal branding, when you brand on your own name, has always been an issue. Even in 40, 50, 100 years ago, when your company name was your name and you right. passed, it was always an issue. That's why they used to tell us to find a name that wasn't your own identity.
Right.
My brother-in-law passed a year ago, and I just got an email saying, wish him a happy birthday. There's a creepy factor there. Now, with Facebook, you can name someone to be your legacy contact. So if you have an account in Canada and in the US, you can name a legacy contact who can go in and set up a memorial post or turn off your account or do various things. But you have to actually go in and do that. Google, Yahoo, Twitter, everybody has a slightly different set of rules. In some cases, if you don't go in and access your account after a certain number of days, they will delete it.
Okay.
So all your photos, all your emails will just disappear.
Right. And that is a consideration too, right? Because, you know, especially after someone has passed, if you don't have access, you don't have their password, and they've got all these memories stored in video, picture format, that loss of that asset could be quite devastating emotionally.
Yes. And but basic housekeeping rules say back up what you want to keep.
Right. No one does that.
No, but of course nobody does that. Nobody does that. But if it's left up to your executor to figure out what is important to keep online, I don't know about you, but I have a gajillion things online.
Right.
Some of it's valuable and some of it's not. Mm-hmm. For my trademark's valuable, my growing blog post is hopefully will be valuable someday, but some of it I wouldn't need my executor to go through or my attorney to go through when if I become incapacitated. How are they going to figure out what's important? How are they going to figure out where the money flows?
Yeah.
What bills I pay online? What accounts are growing because I'm buying things online and getting my virtual dollars?
Right. Yeah. What do you do with your now worthless air miles? do you leave them to people?
Or something similar to air miles that might have more value, right?
Yeah.
Some of those just disappear on death.
Right.
If you look at their terms and services agreements, not saying specifically air miles, but some of them just disappear.
Yeah, they've got enough issues to deal with. Let's not pile on them.
No, of course not. Of course not. But the interesting thing about digital assets that I want to point out, make sure I mention today, is that we don't actually have rules and regulations in our laws dealing with digital assets.
Right.
So when you're updating your will, when you're updating your power of attorney, you need to make sure that your representatives have the legal authority to deal with these assets on your behalf. So I just did my power of attorney, and let me just, I've given my attorney the authority to access, use, and control my digital assets and devices.
And how do they get your passwords?
Well, we've been told we're never supposed to give our passwords to anybody.
Right.
And the lawyers are still looking at how to do that.
Right.
Without violating the terms and services right. and conditions. So I actually have my passwords separate from my master list and I've encrypted it.
Okay.
That's how I've gotten around it. And hopefully that works. And there's a committee of lawyers that are looking at how we best do this.
That's really an interesting point in that, you know, technology changes very fast. The law tends not to change very fast. I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but when Robin Williams passed, there was a story that came out shortly afterwards talking about some of the things that were in his will, such as the prohibiting of the use of his image or likeness in a hologram, right? Because Tupac had a hologram, like every...
I'm familiar with that,
yes. Every other, you know, concert every couple of years, Tupac makes an appearance, and he's been dead for, allegedly, a long time, right? And so an estate plan needs to be updated as things change in the world. And another example of that would be the assisted dying legislation that has been changing in Canada, right? So this now is something that I think would require maybe an update, at least look over your, you know, your estate plan to make sure that as the rules change, that it's what your plans are still works.
As far as your estate plan outside of Quebec, because Quebec is slightly different, as far as my understanding is, in terms of your actual documentation, nothing has changed from that point of view. But in terms of your family knowing your wishes,
yes,
it's still very important that your close family members and your power of attorney for health or your proxy know what your wishes are.
Right.
Because having it in writing at this point still isn't going to help us yet. We have not evolved yet.
All right. So let me ask you then about organ donation. So I've heard stories, and maybe you can confirm or deny, that when people have signed an organ donation card, it's still possible that sometimes the family will override their wishes. Is that possible? Has that happened?
That is possible. It happens. The family, certainly in Ontario, still has the last say when it comes to organ donation. So it's important, again, to communicate what it is you want to have happen so that your family is aware and will carry out your wishes for you. If they don't know that this is important to you, how would it even happen? If it comes as a surprise when they're dealing with your death,
right,
especially if it's a sudden death,
yeah,
how would they know?
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the costs associated with setting up an estate plan, or at least the variables that you need to consider, because there's going to be a wide range of costs depending on the complexity of your situation and so forth. So can we sort of like break down, okay, if you're young and single and you want to, you know, powers of attorney and will set up a like basic, how much would that cost, all the way up to, all right, you're older, you're more established, you've got lots of assets and accounts and businesses and whatnot. What are you looking at in terms of the costs involved to have a professional put together a proper estate plan for you?
Oh, we could look at it from the costs, or we could look at it from the costs of not doing it.
Oh, let's look at both. Yeah.
Okay.
Take your pick.
Okay. Well, the costs depend on where you live and the other amount of work you've given the lawyer.
Yeah.
And whether the lawyer looks at it as sometimes a bit of a loss leader, because sometimes they think, well, the will is the small part, the settling of the estate and working with the executor after you've passed is where the bigger money is.
Right.
And I mean that in a very respectful manner. So some wills package would deal for will and power of attorney for a single person might be $250, $500, could be as high as $6,000, but it really depends on the individual situation. Okay.
Okay, great. Now, one question that I hear from time to time from parents who may not be thrilled with who their children are dating. They want to know, okay, is there anything I could do such that if our assets were to pass to my children and my children get divorced because I knew it was going to happen, what can I do about that to prevent those assets that I gift from being split down the road?
Oh, parents are always mind readers. I wish I wasn't a mind reader. No, I'm only kidding. I'm not. I know nothing. I see nothing. Well, in Ontario, you can put in your will that any growth on the assets is to be outside of family law. In BC, the rules are different because the Wills Variation Act includes family in a more tighter definition,
right.
And families go to court more in BC, in my experience, to argue that they should have been in the will.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Okay.
All right, and so in terms of if you're a parent and you have these considerations, so when you talk, like, this is something you can talk to an estate lawyer about, and they'll be able to come up with strategies so that your wishes are fulfilled, or is this something that you should is not practical to set up? How does it work?
Well, sometimes you can't do much about it, but what I see people doing, and I like to consider estate planning not for just when you die, but as part of your lifetime process, is people want to help their children get into houses today.
Right.
So they're gifting money in advance. So
right.
I see when you look at part of your total inheritance plan, you might be gifting one child money for a house now, and it might not be time for another child, say, for 2 years down the road. They might just not be ready or not in a position for it at all. How do you equalize the estate plan?
Right.
Right? So do you have a hodgepodge clause in your will to say, even it all out? Do you loan money to the other child and say, I've given one money for a house today, I'm going to give you an equal amount, with houses going up, in say, in the GTA areas, the urban centers, 25-30% a year.
Mm-hmm.
One getting cash, that's not going to keep up with the value of a house,
right,
if it continues the way it's been going in the last
year. It won't.
Year.
It won't. It
no, I don't believe it will.
I'm not a market timer, but man alive, it's crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But it's not just houses. It can be cottages and
businesses,
assets that have tax on it, and other assets that don't have the same tax factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so people equalize things.
And what if you have a sibling? And your parents say, you know what? Your brother's a screw up. He needs more help than you. You're fine. You're accomplished or whatever. We're not going to give you anything because you don't need it. Do you find that the kids will fight over stuff like that? And do they have a legitimate case? Or is it, no, what's in the will goes?
Well, in a lot of cases, it's what's in the will goes. In some cases, one sibling needs more help than the other. And if it's been discussed and understood, that may be okay.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, some parents will help one child out more while they're alive, so the will looks like everything is even.
Mm-hmm.
I find the more things are open and discussed, the better it is.
Yeah, so it comes down to communication, as with a lot of things.
But not all families are good at communication.
What?
I mean, families are families. I mean, let's get real. I mean, we can say, this is what you can do, and then you've got to deal with what's in front of you as best you can. And sometimes having a third person, an outsider at the meeting who tries to help conciliate and negotiate.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about, there's being naming an executor, and then there's being named an executor. So when someone asks you or assigns to you that you've been named the executor, like, does it happen where people don't know, oh, really, I'm the executor? Or
does it happen? Have you ever acted as an executor?
No, not yet.
Okay. Well, it's a job, and it's a job on top of a job.
Right.
If you ask anybody who's ever been an executor.
I have heard that, yes.
If someone asks you to be their executor, you don't have to consider it an honor, and you don't have to accept the job.
Mm-hmm. It's not like being named, you know, maid of honor or the best man. It's not, right?
No. It's you may consider it to be a privilege, but you don't have to consider it an obligation.
Right.
Okay. And people do name their best friends or someone they think can do the job in their will and don't tell them about it. And
Yikes.
It comes as a surprise. The key is, if you're named and you didn't know about it, or you're named and at the time that the person passes away, you're not willing or able to do the job, is that you don't take on any of the duties.
Okay.
Okay.
So how do you do that? Do you just say, no, things have changed?
I'm not able to do it.
Okay.
And you say, sorry, here's the will, or if you had the will, and they have to pass it on to the backup. And if the backup can't do it, then it has to go to court and executor has to be named.
Okay,
but if you can't do the job, that's better than trying to take on the job.
Right. Because it is owner. So let's talk about what the duties are of an executor. And if someone asks you, hey, do you want to be my executor of my estate when I die? And some people will say, oh, at the time, yeah, of course, you know, because they may feel obligated. And then the person dies. What have they signed up for? What do they have to do?
Well, before they even say yes, they should say, well, tell me a little bit about your situation right. and what powers are you giving me to do the job? They shouldn't just say, yeah, that sounds great, because right. it's not great.
Right.
Okay. It could be a 2-year job.
Right.
And it is an onerous job. So they have to do everything from canceling your mail, if you have anything that still comes by mail,
right.
Settling up with Revenue Canada, because mm-hmm. this is the one time, your death is the one time you get to come off Revenue's mailing list.
Right.
The only time you get off their subscription list.
Right.
Okay. They have to deal with, if you live in a house, they have to deal with all your utilities. Mm-hmm. They have to deal with all your accounts. They have to file your, not only your final tax return, but any estate tax returns from the time you die to the final tax return. Mm-hmm. Any back taxes that you might have had to do. They have to figure out the best way to report your taxes so you don't pay any more tax than necessary. And the rules when you die are somewhat similar to when you were alive, but there are different rules. Mm-hmm. So it can make a big difference to how much final tax you actually pay.
And they would have to be responsible for canceling your gym membership, which is impossible to do.
And dealing with your smelly socks, too.
Right. So it can last 2 years, sometimes longer, depending, again, on the complexity of the state. You have to, get those certificates of death and send it to a number of people, your financial institution. Like, it is a big deal.
Even a simple estate takes months.
Yeah. And what is there any compensation available? Because if it takes so much time away from your life, do people, when they're writing their estate plans, do they assign an executor's fee when they write the will? Does the executor decide how much the executor's fee will be according to a prescribed schedule? How does that work?
Well, there's two different ways it can work. Actually, there's more than that, but the basic two ways are this. One is each province has a suggested fee, mm-hmm. Or you could put the fee in your will, but the beneficiaries have to agree to the fee.
Okay.
So if the fee seems overly generous, let me put it that way, mm-hmm. to the amount of work that needs to be done, the beneficiaries can challenge the fee mm-hmm. and say, no, that's too much, and it can be brought down.
Right.
So say the only thing in the estate basically was selling a house mm-hmm. and the executor fee was 5%. That might seem to be an awful lot of money for what the executor actually had to do.
Right. Especially in this market when it will sell in a few hours.
Well, why do you think I brought it up?
Yeah, then you're asking, wait, why am I paying the realtor 5% and then you 5%? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, especially if they were house poor.
Right, right.
And didn't have a lot of other assets.
Right. And is there a difference in the tax treatment if you receive an executor's fee versus receiving, say, just the residual from the estate in terms of cash?
Good question. The executor fee is considered regular income.
Right.
So if you're the only beneficiary under a will,
you wouldn't take any fee because you'd just be taxed on it.
You'd just be taxed on it. Right. You'd rather receive the inheritance under the will.
Got it. That's a good point.
That's very important.
Yeah. Okay. I think we'll stop there because if people want to learn more, and I think they should buy the book.
Well, I certainly think so.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about this book? It's called You Can't Take It With You, Common Sense Estate Planning for Canadians. And this is now the 6th edition. And you've sold, over the 6 editions, over 100,000 copies.
Yes.
That's amazing.
That makes it a Canadian success story all on its own.
Yeah, no kidding. That is a huge accomplishment. My book, which sucks compared to yours.
Oh, you don't have to say that.
I think I was checking the royalty statement the other day. I think it was, hasn't passed 10,000 copies yet. And so 100,000 copies with a Canadian-specific focus on estate planning is phenomenal. So tell us what is in this book. At the end of every interview, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the format, everyone gets a commercial for themselves. So feel free to brag. Feel free to have a full-on commercial for why people should buy this book.
Well, I wrote it for one thing, and it's not written for lawyers. Mm-hmm. This is written for people who are curious and need to know about estate planning. It tells you from A to Z what you need to know about estate planning. Just buying the book alone will save you dollars in legal fees. You'll be able to be prepared with the questions you need to ask, and you'll find out things you never even thought you needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It covers estate planning, from why you have to have a will to tips and traps mm-hmm. when it comes to estate planning. It talks about ways you can minimize probate, minimize taxes, how you can do estate planning for yourself and include yourself as one of your beneficiaries, because I believe that you should be one of your beneficiaries when you're looking at your estate planning. Mm-hmm. The government does not take 50% of your estate. That's a mistake. You don't have to believe that, but the government does want to be one of your beneficiaries when you pass away. So let's make sure they're not getting more than their fair share. And you can help make your executor's job and your power of attorney's job easier
right.
by doing proper estate planning and make it easier for your family. We all go sometime. We don't know when it is. And estate planning is one of the important pieces of financial planning. So I believe in the book. I didn't just write it because I wanted to write it. I wrote it because I believe in estate planning. Mm-hmm. And I put in it what I believe that everyone needs to know when it comes to their estate plan. So it's available on Amazon.ca.
Yep.
Look for the gold circle. So you make sure that you get the current edition.
Which is the sixth edition.
Which is the sixth. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Preet. Ask for it at your library. They'll get it for you. And if you want any more information, you can email me at info@headspringconsulting.com. And anybody who's tuned in can get it through my website for a special offer of $25, including shipping, if they use the code PREET.
Oh, hey, nice.
Yeah.
I didn't even know you were going to do that.
Yeah, up until the end of July.
Okay, very okay. good. Wonderful. Well, Sandra, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Estate planning is something that a lot of people don't, you know, think to read up on in their spare time like they do with the quote unquote sexier topics like investing, but it is clearly important. I think a lot of financial advisors should put this on their shelves for themselves, especially going to deal with planning as wealth management moves into more than just transactions of investments.
Thank you.
And to all the listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to take advantage of that generous offer that Sandra mentioned. And we will see you next time.